So I thought for the next few minutes we would just mark the 40th anniversary. So just a word about the timing of that. So the first service in the current church building was November 1980. So actually November 2020, we're actually marking the 40th anniversary of the first service. But obviously there was a lot of work before that. And you could say the big step of faith that the fellowship at the time took was actually in the few years before that first service in 1980. And I know quite a few people around now that I can see on the screen were there then. So there will be a little time in a few minutes just to see if we recognise some of the people who were around at the time from some old photos. But I thought I'd just tell the story very briefly. And Louise, you're going to have quite a few former ministers name checked tonight, because the man who was actually the pastor at the time when the decision was taken to build the current building was actually Barry's predecessor, a man called Michael Herbert. And Michael came back to our church most recently when we had the big celebration 2 years ago, the 175th anniversary of Baptist in Sea Green. And Michael came to speak for one of the Sundays, as in fact you did, Barry. And one of the things that, because Michael knew that I was interested in the church history, he left two newspaper cuttings with me. So this was the first one. So this is actually a cutting, and if you read the text at the bottom, don't read it all, but it talks about the 135th anniversary of the founding of the former Baptist chapel. And if you do the sums, that means this was June 1978. And Michael said to me, well, in fact, I think he said to the whole church, this was the moment where everything suddenly became public. This was the point of no return. Because up until then, the plans and so on had been laid in meetings and I suppose deacons' meetings and church meetings and so on. But this was the point where the church went public and actually took the step of faith to have this open air service on the site where the church is now built. And he said that was the point where he realized, Michael realized, there was no going back. The money hadn't been raised at that point, the planning permission hadn't been gained, but they actually stood in a field in the middle of the new estate and said, this is where it's going to be. And I think it's probably fair to say that before that, the scheme was viewed with a certain degree of consternation, if not to say some people thought it was completely harebrained to move from what was a very pleasant premises, the new chapel in Chalfont Road, and to stake our claim right in the centre of the new estate. Anyway, that was the first picture that Michael shared with me. This was a little bit later on. Unfortunately, the newspaper cutting is missing the left-hand edge. So if you start to read that, it's quite hard. But basically, the first paragraph of that reads, "A dream which the people of Sea Green have prayed for in the last 2 years was realised this week when workmen began laying the foundations of a new Baptist church." And this newspaper cutting was October 1979. And it's interesting. I mean, this is just the public press, so they're all interested in the money and where the money's going to come from and so on. But it's interesting, and in the third column of text there, about halfway down, Michael Herbert says, "We have a deep belief that we are not just here to raise money for things, but we're here to serve and witness for Christ." And I'm sure that's a message that we would all very strongly believe. And echo today. So, although we are, in a sense, celebrating the anniversary of a church building, actually, I think what we're celebrating is the step of faith that our predecessors took to put the building where it is and to be a witness in the centre of Sea Green. So, building started fairly swiftly after that. Now, these people are standing in what is currently the foyer of the church, and you can just about see on the left-hand side there a kind of door frame. I'll show you why they, well, I'll say now that this is the laying of the foundation stone of the church, and I'll show you a few more pictures of that on the next one. But this is the one I thought we would just pause briefly there. Now everyone's on mute, and because this is up on the screen, I can't see people. But if you recognize anybody, or if you recognize yourself, please feel free to come off mute at this point and just point out where you are.
We can see Neil and Linda.
I've heard that Neil and Linda are on this. Can you say roughly where they are? Is that Barry?
Top left.
Extreme left.
Yeah.
Yes.
Neil's got the moustache.
So that's you looking very dapper, Neil, then, is it? And Linda next to you. I know Neil and Linda are on. Perhaps they're too far away from their screen. But yeah, I was told that's Neil and Linda. Anyone else that you recognise?
Denise Bishop is in the centre of the screen.
Yeah.
With the white hair.
Indeed.
And next to her, I think, is our son-in-law, Mark Ridley.
Oh, wow.
And also Joanne Herbert.
Yeah.
Well, I think the couple in the foreground with their backs to us, I think they are Heather's parents who would have been there, Heather Herbert's parents.
Is Michael and Heather Herbert's parents in the foreground?
Oh, yes.
Well, is it Michael's?
Yes.
Or Heather's? I thought they were Heather's.
No, it's Michael's.
Right. And the man with the back to us with a little bald patch, I think that's Peter, isn't it? Peter Lee? Who was the warden at the Princess Marina Centre. And you can also see Jennifer Lee just near Denise Bishop. Am I right, Neil, Linda?
I'm sat too far away, I'm afraid.
can't see, really.
Anyway, I think there are about 200 people there from reports I've read at the time. So,
is that Craig Hawes in the middle at the top wearing a tie?
Oh, it could be. Would he have been that old? He probably would have been.
He was about the same age as one of the Ridley boys, I think.
Anyway, let's go on to the next picture. So this is what everybody was looking at, which is the laying of the foundation stone. And just to comment briefly on the background, you can see that actually the church was one of the first buildings on the estate, because where those trees are and the fence in the background is now Woodpond Close and all the houses that were built along there. And I've told that the gentleman laying the stone is a man called Sidney Greenfield.
What?
Who was Sidney Greenfield? Why did he lay the foundation?
He was, we used to do all our covenanting by him to Gold Hill.
Okay.
Before we had our own scheme.
Okay.
He was a dear man of God.
Lovely. Thank you, Neil. Anyway, so that was the laying of the foundation stone, October 1979. Obviously, the building work then pressed on full steam ahead. This was a picture, I think, that Colin Walker let me have a copy of. Obviously, the church almost finished, but all the fitting out to do. Now, you'll all remember, or many of you will know, that we had, a much more minor refurb more recently within the last 2 or 3 years. And during that refurb, I was actually approached by a very long-term resident of Seer Green, a man called Steve Slade. And Steve's asked to have a look inside the church as it was a couple of years ago. So I took him around, showed him the building work. And Steve, I hadn't appreciated, he was one of the 6 builders of this building. And he told me most of it, in fact, almost all of it was done by hand. The only bit, apparently, he said that they got a crane in for was to lift the spire onto the top. And he said the most difficult thing to build was the roof of the sanctuary. And obviously, everyone who's been in the church and looked up will know that's a pretty irregular shape. And he said they laboured long and hard over building that. And the other thing, obviously, at that time, all of the roof of the or the ceiling of the foyer was down because we were having the new front put on. And you possibly remember the builders that we've had most recently had all the problems with the steel beams in the roof that they had to cut and drill out and everything. Anyway, Steve Slade had a good laugh at that. He said both it was ever so hard for them to lift them into place in the first place. But he said they built the church to last. And that's why there was so much steel work in the roof. Anyway, the final picture, and this is only a very brief summary of that time. This is what Sydney Greenfield was laying. Obviously, we preserved that October 1979 to the glory of God. And then the very famous passage, "Hitherto the Lord has helped us." And I'm sure that many of you know that's from 1 Samuel chapter 7, where the Israelites had just had a great victory over the Philistine army. And their victory had been made certain by God's divine intervention. And Samuel stood in their midst and declared, "Thus far," or "Hitherto, the Lord has helped us." And then "the Lord himself will provide," I guess is referring back to Abraham's statement in Genesis 22, declaring that the Lord would provide the lamb for the sacrifice. And so that is the message that's on the foundation stone of our church. But as I say, although we are marking the anniversary of a building, I think God has taught us through the pandemic that the building is not the church. The church is us. And as Chris has reminded us, God's presence is with us wherever we are. And so I think it would be good really to mark and to remember the faith of the people that took the step 40 years ago. And I think, as several people have said during our time recently, in a sense, God is calling us to an equally big step of faith, different this time because there's no new building involved, but a church becoming missional, a church that is embedded in the community, is a big step of faith for us. And I think it's encouraging when we look back at the faith of our predecessors and we remind ourselves of the two promises there on that foundation stone. So with that, Barry, obviously you weren't around for the events that I have just recounted. You appeared about 4 years later, but you picked up, I think at that time, the estate was still being built, and you picked up the vision of the predecessors and you joined the church on the journey. So once again, great to have you back with us.
Okay. Well, thank you for asking me to come and be a part of this 40th anniversary. I have vivid memories of the 10th anniversary, actually. That was not long after I'd arrived. And the kind of things that we did on that occasion. Some of you were there, but many of you wouldn't have been on that occasion because you weren't yet part of the church. And some of you, of course, were not yet following the Lord. But we had an open day, which ran on into the evening, and we had static displays. I suspect people like Jill Roberts and Ruth Walker and the like had produced photographic displays that had been mounted around the building, which told the story of the church in picture form and with comment. And then at various points during the many hours that we spent welcoming the villagers to the church, I gave a live presentation which explored the history of the Baptists, not Seer Green, but the Baptists more broadly, helping people to understand where this rather weird sect emerged from. And alongside that, a presentation which, I guess in today's terms, we would say, in which I spoke about Baptist DNA, what it was that marked Baptists out as different in terms of their theology and ecclesiology. And Simon Standen did all the artwork. In those days, he created photo slides of, you know, some of you have got some of them stashed away with all the graphics printed on them. And then he projected it from a slide projector onto the screen. And so my recollection is that was actually quite well attended. We can't do anything of that nature today, clearly, because the building is, to all intents and purposes, out of bounds. And I guess that brings a little bit of a surreal feeling to the experience today, because we're celebrating a building that we can't get into and use right now. But as David suggested, maybe within the purpose of God. It means that our focus is where it always ought to be in any event. It's upon the church as a people rather than a place. And whilst I say that, I have to say that I'm a believer in the value of church buildings. And Sear Green Baptist Church has an outstandingly covetous church building for many of us. I left you and I went to Ilford into a 1907 building that subsequently had a grade two listing slapped on it, which was an absolute pain in the neck. And you spent so much of your time maintaining the plant, the fabric. And then I went on to Braintree Baptist Church, which was a bit older, actually, in terms of its structure and fabric than Ilford had been. And again, had to tolerate all sorts of frustrations around the usefulness or not more so of the building. So you have an amazing building, and although you can't use it right now, absolutely right, David and Chris, we need to be deeply grateful for the sacrifices that others made to give us the building that we now have to use. One of the people that you'd have read about in those clippings would have been Jim Graham, of course, who was so much a mover in the whole vision. Michael, of course, worked for Jim initially and was part of the Gold Hill leadership team and subsequently took over more and more of the responsibility of the independent church in Sea Green. But I can remember Jim walking around the building because they often took it for their leaders' meetings, and we'd bang into each other at coffee or something like that. And Jim would be muttering under his breath, "Thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not covet." So, you know, whilst church, yes, it's people. I mean, please be hugely thankful for the superb building that you have to use. It's a huge asset and an advantage. And what I want to talk about tonight is not so much the place, but actually the people. And so I want to read from 1 Thessalonians, a favourite letter of mine, and from the first chapter. In many ways, I think it's fair to say that the Thessalonian church was something of a model. At least that's what seems to me as I read the way Paul writes to them. And so it begins, "Paul, Silas, and Timothy, to the church of the Thessalonians in God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ, grace and peace to you. We always thank God for all of you, mentioning you in our prayers. We continually remember before our God and Father your work produced by faith, your labor prompted by love, and your endurance inspired by hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. Brothers and sisters loved by God, we know that he's chosen you because our gospel came to you not simply with words, but also with power, with the Holy Spirit, and with deep conviction. You know how we lived among you and for your sake. You became imitators of us and of the Lord. In spite of severe suffering, you welcomed the message with the joy given by the Holy Spirit. And so you became a model," there it is, "a model to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. The Lord's message rang out from you not only in Macedonia and Achaia, your faith in God has become known everywhere. Therefore, we do not need to say anything about it, for they themselves report what kind of reception you gave us. They tell how you turned to God from idols to serve the living and the true God, and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath. And the reason I want to speak about people today, and particularly the church that is Sea of Green Baptist Church, is because you can have the best building in the world, but unless the people who call that home are full of passion, then the building will be not particularly helpful in your gospel ministry or mission. The building needs to be full of people who passionately follow Jesus. You might say to me, well, in practice, what does that really look like? And I'd like to suggest to you that if we think about the trinity of virtues that Paul speaks about when he speaks to the Thessalonian church, and most of you will know a trinity of virtues that he mentions repeatedly in his correspondence, then if these things are true of us, we will be the people that can make good use of a building that others would die for. What is that trinity of virtues? Well, it's in verse 3 of the chapter I read from. The trinity of virtues is faith, hope, and love. Though listed here, for no particular reason, I don't think, though I may be wrong, as faith, love, and hope. And if we are people who manifest these things, then with or without a building, we are sure to be impactful. So let me unpack these three virtues as briefly as I can, and hopefully that'll be helpful to us today as we think about where to from here. The first thing, therefore, we need is a faith that emboldens us, a faith that emboldens us, that creates courage in our hearts as we serve the Lord. In retirement, one of the things I've enjoyed doing is doing more reading than I've ever had time to do before. And I think one of the books that I found most provocative, and I'll hold it up so as you can see it, is this one, The Faith of Leap, which is subtitled Embracing a Theology of Risk, Adventure, and Courage. And in a nutshell, because I know you won't all go out and buy it, though some of you might, but in a nutshell, the writer argues that the church has become alarmingly risk averse. And this fear of risk, he argues, questions the very right of God's people to call themselves God's people. And more than that, it has undermined the capacity of the church to keep in step with the Spirit. For the Spirit wants us to embrace risk, not to run away from it. And so he argues that only as we rediscover our courage will we ever be true followers of Jesus. For Jesus embraced risk constantly. Not least, of course, when he decided to become a man amongst men. That was a hugely adventurous, risk-filled decision. And not only that, but as we read the story of the earliest church, we discover that the courageous character of Christ is something that's reflected beyond any dispute in the life of the church that we read about there. So we need to rediscover this courage, this willingness to venture and adventure with God that is the very essence of the church that is really following in the steps of the Master. Incidentally, and it's something of an aside, but I think it's an important insight and worth pondering, he argues that only when we do this, actually, is the church likely to become attractive to those groups that are sadly most conspicuously absent from so many of our churches. And I'm talking about young people, and I'm talking about men. These people, he argues, will be attracted by a group of people that are moving forwards on an adventure with God. And for that reason too, he says, we need to take this call to risk and courage seriously. One of the illustrations that sticks in my mind is about two churches that were forming a partnership. One church was in the affluent suburbs of the city. The other church was right in the midst of all the mess in the inner city. And the suburban church had very commendably sought to forge a partnership that was supportive of the church in the inner city. The first time that the inner city pastor went out to the suburban location, he was given a tour of the buildings, and he was confused by a sign on some of the room doors, and it said, "Nut free zone." And he said to the pastor, "What on earth is that about?" And he said, "Well, some people, you know, they're worried that they may be allergic to nuts. And so in order to take away that fear and anxiety, you know, the church is a nut-free zone." The pastor from the inner city could barely contain himself. And the reason for that was that in his place, he needed signs which would say gun-free zone, drug-free zone, hooker-free zone. To say nut-free zone just was bonkers, because it reflects a fear that's unhealthy, that's diminishing of any willingness to take risks in the service of Christ. Now, I'm not denying that for some people, nuts is a serious problem, but surely it illustrates the lengths to which we sometimes go to remove the possibility of things going wrong, when the reality is that life is never risk-free. And it shouldn't be made risk-free, as those of us who are older might want to affirm. Here's some quotations that give you something of the flavour of his writing. "A church addicted to security and safety is not the church of Jesus Christ. The church of Jesus Christ needs to wake up, embrace adventure, or continue to remain a religious ghetto for culturally co-opted, fearful, middle-class folk. Our very souls," he says, "is at risk." And one final quotation: "Christianity is an adventure of the spirit, or it is not Christianity." Now, clearly I can't speak for you and how you respond to some of that stuff. Maybe some of you are feeling somewhat offended. I don't apologize. For myself, I think we need to hear this stuff. And it's urgent that we re-embrace the concept of risk and set aside some of the fearfulness that sometimes characterizes our decision making. And may I say, in my view, if you're serious about being missional, this will be a failed enterprise unless you're prepared to embrace risk and be courageous. So looking to the future, we need to manifest bold, courageous faith, the kind of faith that Paul speaks about amongst the Thessalonians. So the question is, do we? And if not, will we? And what might that mean and look like? The second thing that needs to be true if we're to make good use of this wonderful building as ours is that we need to manifest a love that defines us, a love that defines us. This is the second of the trinity of virtues that is spoken about in the verse we're pondering. Now, you don't need me to tell you, surely, that the Bible is explicit that love should always have been the hallmark of God's people, not just of the church. When Jesus is asked by religious scholars, summarize the law for us, Jesus says, well, I think this is what does it for you. You need to love God with everything you've got, and you need to love your neighbor as yourself. This, says Jesus, summarizes the whole law. And then, of course, in talking about not Old Testament law, but New Testament praxis and priority, he says in John's gospel, as you well know, that by this will they know that you're my disciples, if you love one another. So the trademark of the church, according to Jesus, needs to be love. And not the kind of love that often is spoken of so easily and glibly within society today, but the kind of love which will demand a huge amount of us, just as it demanded a huge amount of the Thessalonians. If we love rightly, if we love biblically, what does that need to look like? Well, first of all, it means we need to love practically. And you'll notice in the text here that that Paul writes about the labor prompted by love. Love was not something they spoke about. Love was something that they did. It was intensely practical. John in his first epistle says this, "Let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth." So the only love that passes muster is a love that has practical expression. Anything else is just hot air. Secondly, if we're going to love aright, we need to love sacrificially. Some of you know that the Greek language has a fairly diverse spectrum of words that are used for love in the English language. And we miss something of that that range in our own use of the one word. But the word here is the word which will be familiar to many of you, the word agape, which is the particularly sacrificial love that Jesus displayed so completely in his own life. And this is the love that we are called practically to express. the love that is prepared to pay a price to express itself. And thirdly, if we're going to love aright, we need to love indiscriminately. You'll remember the most famous, I guess, of Jesus' stories, the story of the Good Samaritan. And the whole point of that story is to illustrate what it means to love your neighbor. The biblical scholar he was debating with knew the answer. Well, yes, the whole all summed up by loving God and loving your neighbor. But then it says, seeking to justify himself. Interesting phrase. Seeking to justify his lovelessness, his selectivity. Jesus told a story that blew that to pieces. We're to love anybody that has a problem, irrespective of who they are. True Christian love, the love that is meant to define us, is meant to be indiscriminate. And if we're tempted to doubt the breadth of the loving that's required of us, then the Sermon on the Mount uncomfortably tells us that we need to love our enemies. There are no prizes, says Jesus, for loving the people that are easy to love or love you back in return. Anybody can do that, he says. No, you're to love everybody indiscriminately because you're the children of God. Just as God loves all, righteous and unrighteous alike, so we, as the children of God, if we are his children, need to love with the same indiscriminate favor and grace. And it's my conviction that if we can really get hold of this and make it real, then people who presently have no interest in church or anything about it or what it stands for will find it difficult not to feel that there's something here worth investigating. William Barclay says this: more people have been brought into the church by the kindness of real Christian love than by all the theological arguments in the world. And more people have been driven from the church by the hardness and ugliness of so-called Christianity than by all the doubts in the world. I think that's true. In my experience, that's true. And once again, please permit me to suggest that your commitment to a new missional approach will count for nothing unless behind it lies this quality of love that people experience as they encounter you and encounter the things that you choose to do. So we need to manifest a faith that emboldens us, but we need also to manifest real Christian love. Love that's practical, sacrificial, and indiscriminate. So the question again is, do we or will we? And if we will, what might that mean? And so the third thing, the third of these virtues that we come across is the virtue of hope. And so we need a hope, I suggest, that sustains us. A hope that sustains us, because that's what we're told here, that it was hope that helped them to endure. Just going to have a drink of water. Now, the reality is that as you read your Bible, the distinction between faith and hope is often very blurred. And they can almost be used interchangeably on very many occasions. But plainly in this context, Paul was wanting to draw a distinction. And I suggest to you the distinction being drawn is that while faith is spoken of in the context of our present works, which need to be works of faith, hope looks to our future reward. What lies beyond the fulfillment of our works and faith, that which is promised us by the Lord because we serve him as his faithful people. And so one of the very prominent themes in the whole Thessalonian correspondence, not just the first letter, but equally the second, is upon the second coming of Christ. And you had the first mention of it at the very end of this first chapter that I read to you. In other words, we need to be people who have no doubts about what the future holds for us. And this was important. The Thessalonians were at one and the same time a church which was outstanding in its life, but it was also a church that was under the cosh, experiencing severe suffering because of their commitment to Christ. And you'll have seen that mentioned in verse 6 of the chapter that I read to you. And if you read on through your letter, you will see that Paul clearly is very anxious that the pressure is such upon this congregation that they could turn their backs upon their faith. And so for this reason, he sends Timothy in chapter 3 to find out whether they're coping. My point is this: future hope and certainty about what the future holds is one of the things that helps us when times are hard. And significantly, in Hebrews chapter 11, that tremendous chapter that describes some of those that we need to emulate as we walk by faith and exercise courage, there is a very conscious link made by the writer between the clarity with which these heroes of the faith saw the future and their ability to keep walking by faith. And this is particularly true when he speaks about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who saw the city that was not built by human hands, and the kingdom that was not again established by men, but by God. Because this was such a reality in their hearts, they were able to live the life of faith and service that they did. So hope is not a luxury. Hope is essential if we're going to be the people who make an impact in our day and in our age. Now, you will have recognized as much as I have, I'm sure, that the pandemic has been characterized by deterioration in people's mental health. And understandably so, there are very good reasons why lots of people are struggling at the moment. If we've been fortunate enough to miss the impact of the COVID pandemic, we need to thank God for it. But for many people, that's not true. The truth is that many who live alone are struggling with the enforced isolation and separation. Many who have fears about their jobs are struggling to cope. Many who've seen a loved one die are struggling to cope. And many with uncertainty about what the future holds are struggling to cope. Now, it seems to me that in such a climate, there is something profoundly attractive, not about Colgate smile Christianity that doesn't acknowledge there's real issues that people are facing, and that some of the present outcomes are still uncertain. But I'm talking about the attractiveness of being people that live rooted and grounded in convictions that, in spite of everything, build hope in our hearts. A hopeful people, you see, who know clearly that Jesus is Lord and the kingdom is coming and that everything sad and bad one day get fixed. People who know these things will shine the light of hope into the midst of the darkness of insecurity and uncertainty. And I don't want to be a prophet of doom, so don't misunderstand me. But make no mistake, uncertainty is here to stay. Beyond the resolution of the present pandemic crisis, there'll be something else that equally overshadows human life in a way that will create anxiety in people's hearts. Of course, doesn't our Bible teach us that the end times will not be characterized by tranquility, but by trouble? Isn't that what we're taught so clearly by Jesus and so clearly by John in his revelation? And it's for that reason, again, I dare to suggest that the church that will be missionally effective needs to be a church with no doubts about where history is headed, nor about who controls that history. Only the church with a sure and certain hope, like the Thessalonians, will shine in the way that they did in their world. Only such a church is in a position to provide the security and the certainty that people want and need. So we need to manifest not just courageous faith, not just to be defined by real Christian love, but we need to manifest a peaceful hope in the midst of the world's turmoil. And the question is, do we? And if not, will we? And how will we make sure that we reinforce in each other's hearts that, in spite of everything that's going on, Jesus is Lord? So you've got a fabulous building. Thou shalt not covet, he says to himself. But are you the people that you need to be to really make use of it? Are you characterized by a faith that emboldens you, by a love that defines you, and by a hope that sustains you?